Hey, hey, welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We have made season two. This is episode one, and I am Scott Pianowski. Thrilled to be back for another year of baseball talk, fantasy talk, some silly talk, all the stuff that you came to know last year and hopefully you came to love. And who better to be in the leadoff spot than Fred Zinke, my colleague at Yahoo. You know him pretty much all over the industry. He's worked for MLB.com. He's worked for Baseball HQ. He's done work with RotoWire. He's taken home a bunch of hardware in industry leagues. So he's one of the strongest players we have and a good friend of mine. Hello, Fred Zinke.
Hey, Scott. Yeah, I'm honored to be on the debut episode of season two. And yeah, just excited to be back talking baseball.
Me too. Can't wait to do it. And you know, for everybody out there who is interested in the pod, if you enjoy it, you can help us out by giving us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. Please spread the words to your friends. Follow us on Twitter at Yahoo Fantasy. I'm at Scott_Pianowski. And Fred, what's your Twitter account?
At Fred Zinke MLB.
Okay. So there's all the different ways you can reach out to us. Connect. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. And again, please share with your friends and rate us very liberally and friendly if you do enjoy the program. Let's jump right into it, Fred. What greater way to talk about fantasy baseball than to start talking about fantasy hockey? In the Yahoo Fantasy Friends and Family League this year, we made the switch from a rotisserie scoring to a head-to-head scoring. It's categories and it's head-to-head. I'm not getting too into weeds on that, but I feel like it gave a shot of adrenaline to a league that maybe had gotten a little bit stale in the roto format. I think a lot of people are enjoying this head-to-head format. It's the immediacy of every week. You're playing somebody, you have a result that is based on what happens over the past 7 days. You get, I think, four pickups per week to massage your roster. So you can do different things, but it's not like you have to stream 27 picks during the week. And I've been toying with maybe making the Yahoo Baseball Friends and Family League a head-to-head format too, just because I feel like we've gotten a lot of positive feedback and people have really enjoyed it. I've seen some industry talk about this. Some people are really old school with the roto format. Other people think head-to-head is maybe more interesting. Just talk about where you stand on this topic and what do you think we should do for the Friends and Family League?
Well, I've always been a roto guy. I think that's just kind of where I started because roto was so popular maybe 20 years ago. And then continue to be a roto guy, I think, because I got into working in the industry, and the industry leagues tend to be roto leagues, almost all of them. You know, most of the Tout Wars leagues are industry leagues or are roto leagues, Labor's and roto league. And then I got into the NFBC contest, kind of chasing better competition, and those are roto leagues. Yeah, I'm familiar with head-to-head. Obviously, I play fantasy football a lot, which is head-to-head, but never really got into it in baseball. And through the hockey league, you're right. I find myself much more attentive to my team because of the weekly format. And I think, and as you said, I think other people are too. I really enjoyed the transaction cap of 4 ad drops in a week. It allows you not to stream. You can make a couple, I think out of those 4, you can make 2 or 3 smart streaming moves for that week, and maybe one move you make per week or two is a long-term move where you pick up someone who you might have some interest in holding on to, you know, for a long time. So I think it gives you like a nice mix there. You can hold your moves till later in the week and try to capitalize on Saturday and Sunday in tight categories, or you can use them earlier in the week. So I find the strategy of it really fun. I think the Yahoo Friends and Family League might be an interesting place to try it. It's not a money league. It's just a pride for fun league. So I think that might be an interesting spot to try it. I get that people don't want to, you know, play around with it in when they're spending a lot of money. That being said, you know, I think the data backs this up. I think at Yahoo and the other big service providers that half or more than half of fantasy baseball leagues nowadays are head-to-head, whether categories or points. So I think it is something the industry needs to get more in tune to.
All good thoughts there. And a couple of other things that come into play with head-to-head. It turns out that one of the owners in our hockey league has had just some stuff going on off the ice, hasn't been engaged with his team as much as everybody else is. So it turns out when you play that one team, you're getting a bunch of points that week. And that's not ideal, but at least it's kind of the same for everyone. He's been out of the loop for a while. You do need an even number of owners for head-to-head. It doesn't work with an odd number of owners. And I guess one thing that could maybe be spun as a positive is that the people who are out of contention, because one of the most frustrating things about fantasy baseball, right, is the people who get out of contention, August comes around, they're going on vacation, September comes around, going back to school, their fantasy football is obviously a monster in the fantasy landscape. if you're in a head-to-head league, you don't make the playoffs. You're not playing in September anyway. So at least if your team kind of tanks, I would hope that you would keep a competitive front, you know, just respect the integrity of the league. But then at least maybe you may not be stuck playing in September.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, really specific to fantasy baseball. And I think that's very true. I guess I can even see that with our hockey league. Like, I know some of the people in it are really hockey specific, but then there's people in it such as you and me who work in different sports and write about different sports. So when hockey gets down to those last few weeks of the regular season and we're into fantasy hockey playoffs and we're knocking on the door for fantasy baseball, we'll kind of separate the league into two groups, the people who no longer need to pay attention anymore and the people who still really want to pay attention because they're in our league playoffs. I think that's a great point. And I think really the last thing I mentioned about the head-to-head leagues is something the industry needs to think about a lot more. On most podcasts, in most articles, you get a lot of roto-heavy advice, but we know the data says that a lot of people are playing in head-to-head leagues. So I think for industry writers and podcasters and such, like getting yourself into some head-to-head leagues so you have some of that perspective is probably really valuable in just trying to help more people.
You know, my favorite tweak, I think, of this head-to-head league is the 4 transaction cap per week, because it, as you were saying earlier, you really have to judge the pros and cons of, okay, do I immediately attack the schedule for that week and try to get the best pickups early, or do I need to find out where the shape of my matchup is going? Do I need more help at goalie? Do I need more help on the defensive stats? And this is we have a dynamic scoring in this hockey league where we're using hits and faceoffs and all certain things, different things. It's not just goals and assists and stuff like that. But so it becomes a question of where is it most intelligent to use my pickups? And when we first got in the Friends and Family Baseball League, we had no transaction cap. So you could, I think one year I might have picked up 300 or 400 guys. There was no cap. There's no reason to, if you had a cuttable guy, you might as well just pick up somebody else. And as I've gotten deeper into the fantasy experience, I've become more comfortable with transaction caps, whether it's seasonal, it's weekly, just the idea that you can't willy-nilly, like for example, in labor, it's a $100 fab budget. Every pickup has to be at least $1. So theoretically you could have $101 guys, but you know, if you're going to get anybody people want, you're going to spend more than a buck. I just like the idea that you can't willy-nilly. And again, I used to play this way when there was no cap. But I think the idea that, okay, there's a move I want to make, but the opportunity cost is that it means I can't make a move later. Is it worth it to jump in now? I think that adds intrigue and just some nuance to the fantasy experience. And to me, those are always good things.
Absolutely. I'm a really big proponent of transaction caps. And I know what you mean with the hockey league. I'll maybe use one move a week, two tops, like where I think it could be a long-term move where I like the way a player's playing. And then the other moves are streaming moves, and I'll try to save those and space them out. Like I won't use 3 out of my 4 transactions in the first couple of days of the week because that could burn me later on. So I've always thought with the transaction caps, I think that they acknowledge the fact that a lot of people in the league, you know, have a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, people in the league, whether they have kids and are really busy with that, whether they work multiple jobs, odd work schedules. I've always been down on league formats that reward people for just being online all the time, mm-hmm. just being on their phone all the time. I just don't know if that's where we want to go as a society where, you know, where you're rewarded for that. And you're like, hey, I pick up, you know, now getting back to fantasy baseball, I pick up every new closer because I stay up every night until 1 or 2 in the morning. And I'm just glued to my phone and computer. I don't know if that's the point of fantasy baseball. Like that doesn't really show any knowledge or skill. I mean, it certainly shows dedication, but I don't know if that's what we're really going for. So I like the transaction caps in that way. Like, yeah, sometimes you might hit on something where in hockey, where a goalie gets hurt and you happen to be online and grab the backup, or in baseball, right? Maybe you get a new closer or someone gets put in the rotation and you happen to be online and you get them first. But there can only be so many of those moves each week. So you really do have to be thoughtful about the transactions. And then it does, I think I like the thoughtfulness better than just being, like you said, like reactionary. You make 300 or 400 transactions in a year and hope that 50 of them stick as really smart moves. I like the thoughtfulness over that.
It's a great point. I know Ron Chandler, fantasy baseball titan, baseball HQ, used to talk about in some of these leagues where it's first come, first serve, and there's no cap. It's like pinball. It's just, you're just reacting. You're just hitting a flipper. And I like the idea that you have to put that secondary level of thought and decide if you actually want to take away from your resources because you're going to feel it later. So a lot to think about there. We discussed this topic today because we know people are still setting up their leagues. Yahoo Fantasy Baseball, of course, is open for business. Renew your leagues, start your new leagues, get going to the 2020 baseball season, and you know, maybe give some thought to a different format. Let's get into some player talk, Fred. You know, even though we've always had a good relationship, I see that you wanted to troll me this year. I took Nolan Arenado in our recent labor draft a couple of weeks ago with the 14th overall pick, and then you did our third base primer last week, and you're pretty much telling people, hey, stay away from this Arenado guy. I mean, obviously, he's been an all-star several years, very consistent, great defensive player, doesn't really help us much for fantasy there, a four-category player. Tell people why you're a little bit down on Arenado this year, and maybe talk about the theory of what should your first pick, what types of things, what type of boxes you look in the check with that first fantasy baseball pick.
Sure. So I wasn't really, if we want to get down to specifics, Scott, I wouldn't say I was really trolling you, because I believe you took Arenado 14th overall. I wrote the article as though it was meant for 12-team leagues. So I just didn't have Arenado in my top 12. I do kind of have him more 14, 15. So I am kind of comfortable with him where you have him. But getting to the bigger picture with Arenado, certainly there's the possibility that he gets traded this season, although I think that's diminishing by the day. You know, now that he's in camp, I think he could get traded partway during the season. That for me isn't a big factor anymore. It was when the rumors were going in January and early February. He would lose value if he's not on the Rockies. I know all the stats that, like, when you leave the Rockies, you aren't just your road numbers times two. That's totally accurate. But you also aren't what you are when you're on the Rockies. Like, I think that's accurate too. Like, and even if he's 90% of what he is when he's on the Rockies, well, 90% is now you're no longer a first rounder. Now you're a second or a third rounder. Those are the gaps. Those are the margins that fantasy thrives on. But my big point with Arenado is just what he does, and he's been so consistent at what he does, but what he does, we're getting more of right now in the fantasy landscape. So the fact, like 4 years ago, the fact that Arenado could get you 40 home runs, and let's just say around 115 to 120 RBIs and 100 runs scored, like that was really separate from the pack in those categories. But now that we've got so many players, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I think it's in the 50s of players who hit 30 home runs last season. And the number of players who got 90 RBIs and 90 runs scored, like he's not what, and he's still rolling along at his pace, but he hasn't moved up and he's not going to. Like, he's going to still be that 40 homer, you know, triple digits. Like, it's totally really, really valuable. But the pack, just it's the baseball, right? It's the launch angles, like whatever. But the pack has moved a little closer to him. And then in the one category where he doesn't help, the steals category, the pack, like those have become even more scarce. The pack has moved back. So the few guys who can help you with that, you know, they've become even more valuable. So nowadays, and we see like a lot of the offseason articles are showing, like, if you want steals and you don't want to have to chase steals in a bad hitter, you need to get those steals in the early rounds. So now I kind of, if I had the choice right now between, say, Jose Ramirez and Arenado, 2 years ago, I take Arenado in a heartbeat. Now I think I might take Ramirez because I just want the 25 steals. I don't want to have to chase steals later on in the draft. I'm much more comfortable chasing power hitters. That's kind of my thinking on Arenado. It's about team construct. I don't think anyone's going to regret taking Arenado, but they might regret some of the base stealers. This is now we're back to a roto discussion, but they might regret the base stealers who are crummy hitters who they have to take later on in their draft just to get some steals to compete in that category. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense. Two themes I was thinking about as you were going through that. One, I think one reason why Arenado is always a really easy pick for me is I just love a guy with a high floor. And you look at his career scan, he's playing 155, 157, 159, 160 games. I mean, anybody can have a fluke injury, but he's proven extremely durable for five straight years. And his stat lines are so remarkably consistent that I feel like his projection is really safe. His floor is extremely sturdy. And that's the type of player I love to take, a player like that. I mean, we know what his upside is. His upside is he could be the National League MVP. He's, you know, he's got those types of dominant numbers in four categories. So that makes me more likely to want to take a player like that, where I like that there's a track record. I like that there's an established level of durability, consistency. And then there's this thing with stolen bases. I go back and forth on this because, as we know, in the shape of baseball today, teams are stealing less for a lot of different reasons. They've kind of figured out that isn't really a very valuable play with all the home runs. You know, what's the difference between being on first and second? You're still going to score on a home run. teams don't score via the three-hit, four-hit rally as much as they used to. There's a lot of strikeouts in the game today. So we know there's less stolen bases, and there's going to be less stolen bases for our fantasy team. So I could see how, if somebody steals and somebody doesn't, how that would, you know, add some extra value. But I also think we could spin this as, well, if you need fewer stolen bases to compete, what used to get you maybe 5, 6, 7 points in stolen bases, you know, maybe that's 15 or 20 stolen bases fewer now. I'm not sure what the exact number is, but the point is you can be competitive in stolen bases with less steals. Could we also posit that maybe you just need to get less of them anyway? So is it a matter of the stolen bases disappearing, they're more valuable, or the stolen bases disappearing, we need fewer to compete, so let's not worry about it?
Yeah, it's for sure a little bit of both. At the same time, I'm just finding as I've gone through, so I think I've done 3 or 4 drafts so far this year, all none of them are mocks, all drafts that we're playing out. And if you need steals in the later rounds, steals are almost becoming, I don't think this parallel is perfect, but steals are almost becoming like saves. So you can get saves early and pay for them from good closers, or you can chase saves late. But often when you chase saves late and you try to go cheap on it, you end up with bad relievers who you're trying to get saves from. And then the total cost of getting those saves are poor ratios, or maybe they don't keep in saves, they don't keep their job. So you don't get the saves that you thought you were going to get, or the ride's so bumpy, there's a bunch of blowups in there. The steals can be like that a little bit right now, where once I'm chasing steals late, I'm rostering bad hitters who may not be able to hold their starting role on their team. So I may not even get the steals that I wanted. And even if they do hold the role along the way to get the steals, I may have to deal with very few home runs, no RBIs, modest runs scored totals. There are guys that I like in the second half of drafts for steals. In fact, that's one of the articles I'm putting together for Yahoo, which will be in about 10 days from now. But if you're going to, like, if you're chasing steals late in your draft, if you have to go after the Jerod Dysons, John Birdie, some of those guys who can for sure get you 25 steals, but they come with, like, it gets so empty beyond that, that, like, I'd rather chase the late round power hitters. A good example, last night I helped Jeff Zimmerman do one of the NFBC online championships. That's a 12 team league. We were sitting in like round something like 15 or 16, and Carlos Santana was still on the board. Yuli Gurriel was still on the board. Those are good hitters who hit 30 something home runs last year. Santana 100 RBIs, Gurriel 100 runs scored. Like, I'd rather chase those good hitters in those later rounds and just know that I have my steals banked, or that at least that I'm on pace with them, than have to go after like subpar players just because they might get steals. So like I said, I think the best way I can explain the Arenado thing is I don't think you'll regret Arenado. It's just the position it puts you in with the steals, because you still do have to climb to, depends on league size, but 120, maybe 140 steals. Now, the other option is that you could just except that you won't be high in steals. If this just doesn't work out, like, you could draft Arenado and then stick to value the rest of the draft and just say, you know what, if I happen to be fourth last or third last in steals, then so be it. It'll just be my weak category and I'll be awesome in the other categories. I could totally understand going in that direction.
Labor is a league that allows trading. So although I think it's dangerous to go into a season with, oh, I'll just trade for my surplus, at least that is a potential option.
It's a big difference.
Right. You know, if I need to, if I have too much of something, I can get rid of it. If I lack in a category, I can maybe look to address it by trade. I've always said, you talk about the guys who steal bases but don't do much else. I've always said the goal of any draft is to not have to draft a Malik Smith type later in the season, because, you know, can't really hit, doesn't offer a lot of defensive value. And even if he's playing, all he's doing is giving you one or two categories. I like to avoid players like that. Carlos Santana is one of my favorite. I love those boring veterans who have established a high level of consistent return, and yet there's nothing sexy about them. So I think a lot of times you get a decent price on them in the middle rounds. You mentioned Yuri Gurriel, and this brings up one of the elephants in the room for baseball 2020. The Houston Astros, just, it's a new story every day about what's gone on with them. Obviously, they went to the World Series last year, lost in Game 7. There was some front office stuff going on with some really unsavory things that were said by a former executive. The Astros didn't really handle it all that well, but they eventually fired that executive. Since then, all this cheating stuff has come out. Their GM was fired. Their manager was fired. The Astros really kind of botched the PR with all this. We could talk about all that for hours and hours on end. But the bottom line is, what do fantasy owners do? I think we're stepping into a very uncertain period of time with the Astros. We know there's a lot of talent on this team, and we know that whatever advantage, if you want to say that, they got from cheating, it didn't make Alex Bregman a good baseball player. It didn't make Jose Altuve a good baseball player. Justin Verlander was already in the Hall of Fame, as far as I'm concerned, even before he went to Houston. Do you have a stance on how to address Houston players for the new season? Is it just, I know we're also kind of flying blind with the baseball. Is the baseball going to be as juicy and as rabbity as it was last season? But I feel like we need an Astros take, even if the take is a shrug and no, I'm just drafting these guys business as usual. What say you about the 2020 Astros for fantasy purposes?
Right. So I started my projections and I always I go right down to grassroots and I project stats for every player. That's how I've always done it. And I think that's the way that works best because you get to know your player pool so well. I projected each Astros hitter as though there was no story, right? As though nothing was wrong. And then from there, I did shave them down just a little bit for a variety of reasons. We don't know, you know, the full details of 2019 cheating and there's accusations and who knows, but it does seem a little common sense that, you know, if they were cheating and it was working for them, they would have kept doing it. It does seem that cheating would help them. Otherwise, like, what's the point? But the reason I shaved them a little bit, and my kind of common stance is more, I projected the Astros, and I'm not taking an Astros hitter unless he's clearly my top remaining player. If he's clustered with some other players, I'm taking the other players. If he's just barely above some other players, I'm taking the other players. And the reason is I don't like taking players who are in a situation that they're not comfortable in. And I'll guarantee you that Bregman, Correa, Altuve, they did not pursue a Major League Baseball career to be this type of villain. Nobody grows up thinking I'll play in the majors someday and everyone will hate me. And right now, the fans hate them. Their peers hate them. Like, the things being said about them are so bold. We haven't seen anything like this before where guys are just ripping them. Guys are not going to be warm to them when they come to, you know, to Rhodes stadiums this year. Other players won't be warm to them. Forget the fans. The other players aren't going to be warm to them. These guys didn't grow up wanting this type of outcome to their major league career, and they're going to have to wear it this year. And that's not a comfortable situation for them. I've often said that Barry Bonds thrived on being the villain. He could walk into your ballpark, like, get booed by everybody, hit two home runs and just stroll around and like he owned the place. Not everybody is Barry Bonds. And some of these players are going to struggle emotionally and mentally with this villain aspect of their career. Because like I said, and they're young guys, some of them like Correa and Bregman. I don't think they're going to, some of them will handle it well. And I don't want to speculate on which ones. So my tiebreaker is to avoid them unless they're a clear value.
And just a tease for our draft later, as suggested by Fred, we will be drafting sports villains. So if that's something that interests you, if you want to play along with us, that will be the final portion of our podcast a few minutes from now. But I like that you made the point that I do think there can be an emotional drain, getting sick of asking the wrong questions, you know, getting some of the stuff they're dealing with on the road. I mean, we've heard some awful stories about players getting, you know, threats from people. It's just obviously no place in sports. Don't, you know, be a human being. You can root for whoever you want. If you want to go to the ballpark and boom, that's fine. But, you know, leave these guys alone personally. But some players do thrive on that. Bonds was like that. I remember somebody once said that Albert Bell was a player that just needed emotional chaos in his life. He played better with that edge. I don't think Reggie Jackson ever cared when he got booed. He used to just kind of laugh and say, well, they don't boo nobody's. So he almost took it as a badge of honor. So I could see some players maybe thriving on it, but I think most people, just the deluge of media, the sameness of the questions, just that volume of, and the way they've handled it so poorly PR-wise, the story refuses to die. There still could be stuff that comes out. So I think a tiebreaker of not taking the Astro certainly seems to make sense. Let me ask you, Fred, we started to see the spring training games have started. And last night, I was actually, right before I went to bed, I was looking at the box scores from the spring training games. And I'm always just never really sure what to look at. What I ultimately did is I looked at all the pitching lines really quickly just to see, you know, did anybody have one walk, five strikeouts? Did anybody get hammered? It's always funny to me that people steal bases in spring training. I don't know what they're trying to prove, but you know, every once in a while, some people steal 9 or 10 bases in the spring and it will carry over. What, if anything, do you take from spring training results? I mean, obviously the more established player, the less we care about the spring. And so long as they're not hurt, we can talk about those guys in a minute. But as far as the actual results, you know, who's getting hits, who's getting strikeouts, who's doing what, do you care? Do you care about the lineup? And what are you grokking from spring results, if anything?
Sure. Well, I think the most obvious one that everyone talks about are the players returning from injury, right? Seeing how Chris Sale looks this spring, you know, I think that one pretty much writes itself. I mean, you have to keep track of those players who were disappointments last year because they dealt with a major injury. But beyond them, the ones that I really watch are the ones who are in the position battles. So the pitchers who are competing for a rotation spot, unsettled closer roles, and players like, say, for example, the San Diego Padres outfield, which is really unsettled right now. You know, we know that spring training is a small sample size and that it's also like a really uneven sample size because you might face Max Scherzer. And then the guy you're competing against might face someone who's not even going to make the Nationals a few innings later. And there's a huge difference there. At the same time, managers and general managers, they are human and they're going to look at these spring results at least a little bit. So if there's, for example, the Arizona Diamondbacks, there's an open competition at the back end of that rotation right now. If Merrill Kelly finishes the spring with a 12 ERA, he's probably not getting one of those spots. If he finishes with a 2 ERA, he probably is. Like, I also know teams will manage their assets, and sometimes a rookie will outperform a veteran and then get sent down anyways because he has options. But when managers have said, and there are some of those situations around baseball, even in this era of guaranteed contracts, when managers have said, you know, we're not sure, we're going to let these players battle it out, we're going to see who our Nationals third baseman is going to be, for example, those are the players who I want to see. If Carter Kieboom hits 300 this spring, he's your opening day third baseman. If he hits 100, he's probably going to start season in the minors, and that's going to matter a lot for later on in my draft. So that's what I keep track of. Scott, is there any other area that you really look at?
No, I think you hit the nail on the head that, as silly as it may seem, if two players are in a position battle and one guy hits 400 and one guy hits, you know, 210, the guy who hits 400 is going to get the job. That's just what teams do. And I think it's important that we never forget for fantasy, whatever sport you're playing, football, baseball, we have to handicap the managers. We have to handicap, like, a lot of times you'll see closers and people will say, oh, well, this one relief pitcher has unbelievable skills. He should be their closer. But maybe the team prefers a guy with less raw skill, but he fits the ninth inning more. They can use that more dominant guy as a rover, multiple innings. They can bring him in earlier in the game when the game may be in a critical balance. We have to anticipate what teams are going to do and react to that and evaluate our players like that. And just because the team may not, and I mean, going back to Ron Chandler, you know, draft skills, not roles. I get that. But if there's one position where I want to draft the role significantly too, it's closer, because, you know, the guy in the ninth inning is going to get saves. It's not that hard to get them. If you pitch reasonably well, you're going to have a lot of 3-run, 2-run leads where you can even pitch poorly and still get the save at the end of the game. And for all the talk of the teams that may talk about bullpen or fluidity, or we're going to use multiple guys, and we've seen save striation has become an issue over the last few years as there's been fewer saves in the game and they're spread out to more guys. But I really believe most managers at the end of the day would prefer to have a button to push. And it's not, okay, what am I going to do today? Maybe some managers are comfortable with that. But once you have an established closer set and there's a button to push, it means the manager is less likely to be criticized. You can say, look, that's my ninth inning guy. That's who I went with, you know, end of story. So just keep in mind that we have to handicap the managing habits or the organizational habits as much as we do the talent on the field.
That's right. And I'm glad that you brought up Ron's line of draft skills, not roles. I think about that line a lot over the years. I find that line, although true, is really true for deep leagues. And Ron and a lot of our industry veterans really cut their teeth, I find, in deep leagues, like some AL only, some NL onlys, even the mix are 15 teams. And if you're in a 10 team or a 12 team, if you're in a 12 team with a 3 or 4 man bench or a 10 team overall, you actually just don't have space to draft skills and not roles. Like you need, if you're owning a hitter in a 10 or a 12 team league, he needs to play most days. Like, you just don't have bench space or roster space to grab, or he has to be like such a good prospect that you're sure when he comes up, like, he's going to be super valuable. You just don't have roster space for those guys. So I think that's the monitoring the spring stats and stories is you need the roles. You don't have room in a lot of those leagues to draft, you know, oh, he's a really good starter. I think he could be a really good starter. He just doesn't have a rotation spot right now. These things will work themselves out. He'll get his starts this year, like 20 of them or something. Totally good advice in an NL only league, not in a 10 team mixed league. In a 10 team mixed league, that guy's got to sit on waivers and you pounce when he gets his shot, but you just don't have room. So that's the big thing in the spring, is we've got to read what we think teams are going to do. And the spring stats do matter.
That's a great point. I mean, just the development time, how much can you wait for a story to blossom in a 15 team league? You can a lot of times carry guys and wait and think, this is somebody for May. This is somebody for later in the season. We're in those 10 and 12 team leagues. You need more immediacy. And also a player who's in a platoon, even if it's in the strong side of a platoon, a lot of 10, 12 team leagues, you just can't carry those guys. You're going to lose too much playing time. You're going to lose too many at bats. And God forbid they play like a 5-game week. They face the wrong side of the platoon a couple of times. You're getting 3 games. You're getting 9 or 10 at bats. Those guys can be death in a shallow league, but they can be very rosterable in a deep league. Obviously, every league is different. Knowing your specs and your format, extremely important. Most obvious point in the world, but extremely important. And let me throw this out too. In every one of your leagues, go to your calendar, whatever calendar program you use, and put in the date of the first FAB period, because there's always a league. I'm in a bunch of leagues. I'm sure you are too, Fred. I play on some different platforms. Of course, Yahoo is my preferred platform, and I hope you guys give Yahoo a chance. I still think we have the best game, the most intuitive game. Nothing to do with me, but the people designing the game do a great job. But there's always going to be a league on a platform I'm not that familiar with. I won't know when the FAB period is. I won't be ready for it. I'll come home one day. I'll see an email and say, oh, 25 guys get picked up. I've really needed some of these players and I missed the first period. So make sure you're aware of when that first period of FAB runs, because it really is different, seems like, for most leagues. We talked about the Astros earlier, and we talked about stolen bases earlier. And one thing I'm trying to get a handle on, Michael Salfino, who I do another podcast with, him and I were debating this and we didn't agree. Dusty Baker is the new manager for the Astros. The Astros for a long time have been one of those new school teams that didn't want to steal bases. They didn't see the upside of it, even though they have guys who can run. And at times they've run a lot. I mean, Altuve was a dominant stolen base guy a few years ago. He really pulled back on the steals last year, in part because he wasn't healthy. Mike seemed to think that if Baker was willing to run, maybe they would run more. I still think the bent of the front office, even with turnover there and a new GM, I think they're going to be more of the wait for the 3-run homer team. Do you have any sense of how much the Astros might run? Or is that something with new managers? The Red Sox, of course, have a new manager. Cora's out, Renicki's in. Would that make them more willing to run? Again, we're at a time where teams don't want to run that much. I'm curious what you think with Baker. Do you think his assignment to the Astros manager post makes them more likely to run, or they're going to play more like the way they used to? Do you have any sense on how that might play out?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a change with their running game. I actually talked to Jeff Zimmerman over at Fangraphs a bit about that when Baker was hired, and you can do some searches and look up historically, you know, especially for an experienced manager like Baker, you know, how did his past team's running games change when he came in versus what they were like the season or two seasons before he came in? Baker's such a happy-go-lucky guy that I think that the common theory is he'll just let the guys run all over the place. That's not actually his MO. So his teams didn't spike in steals after he got there. They didn't fully drop off the map, but they didn't spike in steals. So I don't think, like, when I think of a steals happy manager, I think of Ned Yost, just because that's a really recent example. Baker's not that guy. So I don't see the Astros really changing. Like, maybe he lets, Bregman's always confused me. Like, he's such a young guy and his steals totals have gone down every year. Like, even notably, like, gone down a few every year. And maybe he takes someone like Bregman and lets him run a little bit more again. So maybe he goes back up to a dozen steals or something like that. But Bregman isn't a steals happy manager. So I don't think that the steals totals are going to go way up. Maybe Altuve goes back up a little bit because maybe some of that decline was injury related. Maybe Dusty lets Kyle Tucker run because that's what he's done in the minors. But I don't think there'll be this huge swing in their steals totals. I did build them up a little bit just with the change in regime, but not much.
It's funny. Sometimes when it comes to steals and stolen base sources, I actually prefer them to be on a losing team. Like, I think about when Jonathan Villar went from Milwaukee to Baltimore, and Baltimore's got nothing going on. They nowhere near contention. They're going to lose over 100 games, and they just let him run as much as he wants. Not it helped that he was successful. He was a high percentage base stealer. He wasn't hurting the team by doing it. But sometimes I think there's like a DGAF approach to some of these losing teams. I think, well, we need to sell something. Maybe that helps Mondesi in Kansas City. VR's on the Marlins now. They're not going to be a contending team. It's curious how I think sometimes the smart teams are going to be more acutely aware of, okay, is this really a high percentage play? When maybe the idea with some of these losing teams is, okay, you know, we got a guy at the front of the lineup. He can run. Let's put that, let's bake that into what we're selling here, the excitement of this guy in the base pass.
I totally agree. And I mean, I think the only manager who I heard right into spring training and say his team's going to run more is Derek Shelton in Pittsburgh. And that, there's a totally a good example. Like, the Pirates are not going to be contenders this year. So it works both ways. I agree with you. Like, there's that don't care attitude of like, well, we're not going to contend this year anyways. Let's experiment with the run game. Let guys try things out on the base pass. Go for it. Entertain our fans. And that helps the steals totals for fantasy. And there's also just, if you're managing one of those teams, you don't look at your lineup and say, well, don't risk the extra base. I mean, look who we have coming up. So Shelton's already said that he thinks the Pirates are going to be really aggressive on the base pass. So maybe someone like Kevin Newman steals a few more bases. That will be offset by the fact that he's not on a great team. So he's not going to have a ton of RBI and run scored opportunities. But, you know, you didn't see Joe Girardi ride into to Philadelphia and say, hey, the Phillies are going to steal all kinds of bases this year. Maybe they will steal a little more. Maybe they won't. But like, he's got to manage that team very carefully because he's got some good hitters in that lineup. So I think you're totally right that those also ran teams can be good sources of steals.
And sometimes you can get some great values too, just because there's nothing sexy about the Pittsburgh Pirates. There's nothing sexy about the Miami Marlins. You know, maybe Newman becomes a great value just because, just, I don't know, less eyes on the team, less expectations, not in the national eye. You won't see a lot of Pirates games on national TV. I could see a lot of times you can get good values from the lower market team. Yeah, okay, they're going to win 72 games. It doesn't mean they don't have fantasy value for us. Let's tackle one more baseball topic, and then we'll jump into our villains draft. Fred, we've already seen setbacks for Mike Clevinger. We've seen setback for Luis Severino. I'm generally very worried about guys, especially pitchers. Look, pitchers, you never know who's hurt, who's going to be hurt, who's been pitching through a sore elbow, and we'll find out after the season, oh yeah, it's been barking for 5 months. Whenever these guys have setbacks, as much as from a human being, I want to see Severino pitch, I want to see Clevinger pitch, I want to see them at their best. It's just baseball's more fun that way. I feel like I move them down to the point that I never say never. I mean, if the discount was good enough, I would draft those guys. But I always feel like somebody's going to be more optimistic about an injury return, especially with a pitcher, than I would be. So it's almost like right now Clevinger and Severino on my board. I am ranking them, but I just expect somebody else to be more optimistic than me. Speaking more generally and not necessarily about these two guys, what do you do when a pitcher gets hurt in the spring? I mean, what's your general MO of how to approach them in an upcoming draft?
Right. Well, I mean, you're going to downgrade them. How much do you downgrade them is really the question. If it's a hitter, I'm going to downgrade them to the end of his time frame that's given, assuming one's given. So if they say 6 to 8 weeks, I'm going 8 weeks. If it's a spring injury, I'll often go even later because their preparation for the season was interrupted. So, you know, so Eugenio Suarez, he's injured right now. He's not going to get his spring training at bats. He might come back maybe even a little later than they think, although I've heard some good news on him lately. But hitters, I'll generally look at the late end of the time frame. Pitchers, I'll go to the late end of the time frame and add about 3 weeks to it, figuring in rehab assignments after that, especially if it's a spring training injury. So, you know, if they say 6 to 8 weeks, I'm going to probably estimate 11 weeks. I'm going to drop their stats based on that. But then I am going to build their stats up a little bit based on the replacement value where I can use someone else in that active lineup spot for the weeks that they're going to miss. Now, what I also have to factor in that I think owners don't often think about is just the value of the spot that they're taking up. So it depends on your league and how many IR spots you have, or if you have IR spots at all. So for example, in the Tout Wars League, which has unlimited IR spots, I don't have to worry about that. In an NFBC style league where they have no IR spots, well, now just holding a James Paxton during April and maybe May, it's costing me a bench spot. It's costing me a chance to try to, as we've talked about, churn that last roster spot, pick up hot starters, pick up possible closers, pick up someone who's, you know, leading the league in home runs 1 week in, and just maybe he hits. Like, that roster spot has value, and tying him up, that's something I really don't want to do. Unlimited IR spots, I'm way more likely to at least consider a Mike Clevinger 5 rounds after I would have normally taken him.
Totally agree. This is a topic we can expand on a different day, but I love being aggressive with those fab picks. You see that plausible upside, try to dip your toe in the pool and see if you can catch lightning in a bottle. And of course, in the NFBC format, with two periods where you can make transactions, it really is nice to have a fluid bench where you come into Friday, maybe your middle infielder's gotten hurt. If you have somebody who can replace them, you can pop them in there. If your bench is littered with 3 or 4 hurt guys, then you may not have that flexibility. That can come into play. I totally agree with you on when they say 6 to 8 weeks, I always hear that as 8 weeks plus. ignore the players. The players are the worst source of information about their own injuries because these guys have been superheroes their whole lives. You know, whether it's they don't believe that they're going to need the full time to rehab or whether it's they want to mark their territory, they don't want to lose their job, they don't want to give out any bad news about them that could be used against them later, seen as malingerers, whatever it is. There's never any incentive for a player to say, you know, I'm a slow healer. They're saying 4 to 6. I'm thinking 6 to 12. Don't count on me. It just doesn't make any sense. So I try to ignore that. And with pitchers, if they're going to get hurt, I just hope it isn't arm-related, elbow-related, forearm-related. I'm more likely to give a pitcher a break if it's, you know, it's maybe a broken toe or it's something that could heal and just be over with. It's not related to the arm, shoulder, elbow. So that will come into play of how I price those guys. But generally, when a player has a major injury, you can almost count on me being out on those guys. And I get it. They're up, you know, people, somebody right now is saying, hey, if Clevinger's injury isn't as bad as I think, he's my second or third pitcher. Look how great my staff is. I see that. It's just generally not going to be the way I play. So, hey, that's a big chunk of baseball talk with my friend, Fred Zinke. You're listening to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. And as we did last year in our first season, and by the way, thank you for everybody who listened, who commented, who tweeted. We did receive an FSWA award for this podcast. I'm very proud of, which speaks to how great.
I'm silently clapping at home right now.
Thanks, man. Well, don't want to interrupt. Speaks to how great our guests were, like Fred Zinke. It speaks to how great our production was with Brett Rader leading that ship. And I'm hoping this is going to be another fun season. We brought the drafts back for this year. We're going to try to have them a little bit tighter. I know sometimes the drafts took on a life of their own last year, and I blame myself for that. The goal, I don't know that we're going to reach it, 5 picks. 5 rounds, 5 minutes, or maybe a couple extra minutes. So it's our 5x5 draft today. Sports villains are what we're drafting. And Fred Zinke, you have the first pick in our 5x5 sports villains draft.
Well, I feel like this guy was going to go, so I need to get him early. I'm taking Ty Cobb, who I think is maybe the best baseball villain of all time. I've watched Ken Burns baseball probably 4 times in its entirety. For listeners out there, if you've never watched it, it's amazing. The Ty Cobb stuff in those early episodes is incredible. Like his ability to be a villain and still be an amazing player, I think maybe is unmatched by any other athlete of all time.
I also told my production crew I tried to be more current with some of our drafting, but no problem with Ty Cobb. You know, didn't even have a uniform number. So when you go to a Tigers game, jersey in theory is retired, but just says Cobb because he didn't have a number. And of course, in the movie Field of Dreams, they mentioned that Ty Cobb wanted to play with those guys. And they said, screw it. Stuff it, Cobb. You're not invited. A great pick in the sports villains draft. I'm going to go something a little bit more current. I'm going to pick a couple of Duke basketball players. I'm going to use them as an entry. When they did a 30 for 30 on Christian Laettner, they called it I Hate Christian Laettner. Now, I'll admit I was actually a big Laettner fan when he was at Duke. But he had a cocky edge to his game. His teammates had a nickname for him that began with the letter A and ended with the letter E. You can probably figure out what that was. He stomped on a Kentucky player in the most famous college basketball game of modern time. Just Laettner just had this, you know, kind of a bad seed element to raise his own game and sometimes infuriate but raise the games of his teammates. And then a couple decades later, Grayson Allen, another guy who just couldn't stop tripping people or you're getting in people's way. Grayson Allen even sounds like a villain's name. So even though Duke is usually up in the standings, there's a lot of people who are pro Duke. I feel like if you're not a huge Duke fan, you probably root against them. So let's take Christian Laettner and Grayson Allen as my first pick in the villains draft.
That's amazing because Christian Laettner was my next pick. So you did a really good job by getting him first. So
my advanced scouting really went to work on you, Fred.
So my next pick is I don't know if I like calling this guy a villain, but to me, he lives forever and I'm staying in baseball and it's Bartman. They're like, what a villain from the Cubs team about 20 years ago with catching the ball. And I know now he's almost like a sympathetic figure, but at the time, I remember watching that game live when he caught the baseball. It's like every fan's worst nightmare. Like you do something that, you know, that you're really excited about and within seconds you realize that you made the worst move of your life. So Bartman, like I say this kind of lovingly putting him on the list, but man, he was a sports villain in Chicago as much as I've ever seen a fan be a villain just in an instant and unintended. Like he wasn't being a jerk. He wasn't trying to be. I to have a 30 for 30 on you as a fan, that's a pretty villainous guy to me.
I feel sorry for him because everybody around him is going for that ball. And then the Cubs had to collapse in a million other ways. You have the Alex Gonzalez error. Just like I don't blame the 1986 World Series on Bill Buckner. The game was already tied for crying out loud. I don't blame that 2003 collapse on Bartman, but man, it's a tough road he's had to hoe. I mean, this is a guy who was a huge Cubs fan and basically changed his life and not really for the better. So I have some sympathy there. My second pick, and I guess it's a couple of coaches who I think are kind of linked together, but I'm only going to pick one of them. I'm going to pick Nick Saban, the Alabama coach, for a very simple reason. There's just a joylessness to this guy. He just never seems happy, never seems content. And maybe that's what makes him a great coach. I mean, there's an argument to be made that to be great at something, you have to be driven so much that you're just not a happy person. If there's a joyous personality to Saban, we haven't seen it. I feel like he'd be drudgery to play for, just like a lot of people who played for Bobby Knight said. You know, they start hating playing after a while. Nick Saban, joyless Alabama coach, is my second round pick.
That's interesting. Bill Belichick was on my list. I didn't pick him, but he was on my list for almost the same reason. So my next one, now I'm going to leave actual sports, and I'm going to pick from my favorite movie, Slapshot, Ogie Oglethorpe. There's so many amazing villains. I could have picked Tim McCracken. There's so many amazing villains in Slapshot. Oglethorpe is just like I'm going to, he's not my only hockey one in this list that I'm going to send out, but he was just so stereotypical of that 1970s feared goon where everyone across the league, you just hope his name's not in the lineup that day. So I think he's a great movie character. In Slapshot, there are so many great, great villains. And yeah, I wanted to make sure I got that movie referenced in this list of villains.
Love it. I'm going to piggyback that pick. I have a hockey pick too. And even though this means after you took Oglethorpe, it means you'll probably never take this guy. But Rob Lowe was in a movie in the mid-80s called Youngblood.
Oh, I know Youngblood.
And Lowe is the pretty boy scorer who never wants to fight anybody. And he runs up with this guy, Carl Racky. He's got the beard. He's a goon. He's just on the ice to beat people up. And they've really cast Racky well. I mean, I see the guy and I'm afraid. I'm afraid he's going to throw an elbow at me. I mean, you don't think he could have played for that Flyers team in the 70s that terrorized the NHL. He could have been a teammate of Ogie Oglethorpe. So for all the people who say Slapshot's the best hockey movie, maybe it is. I think Youngblood's very underrated. You get young Patrick Swayze in it. You have a very small role for Keanu Reeves. Lowe's very good. Cynthia Gibb. Ed Lauder, one of the classic those guys, is the coach of the team. Youngblood's a really good movie. And Carl Racky, very menacing as a sports villain.
My next pick, I'm going to take Tim Donaghy, the basketball referee. I always think that fans are so annoying. This goes all the way down to kids' sports. Whenever they say the ref is on the take, whenever they say the ref isn't legit, I hate that. Like whenever there's bad calls in a baseball game and they say, oh, the umpire, they must have paid him off, or a hockey ref calls some bunch of penalties on one team in a row. How much are they paying you for this game or whatever? Because that's not the case, like 99.9% of the time. And Tim Donaghy, like with him fixing NBA games, which is such a good sport to fix with the foul calls being so pivotal, it's just such an awful thing to do. And it just ruins, like, I know all these like Astros cheating and steroids, these all ruin our view of sports, but man, for a referee to do that, I think it's just such a weaselly thing to do. And to me, he's just one of my least favorite people who has ever come across the sports landscape.
Great pick. I know a lot of people who officiate sports on all different levels. A good friend of mine, Dave Dowd, is a college basketball ref. These guys want to get the game right. They don't want to be the story.
Totally.
I mean, you know, for every time there's an ump show, there's 20 other umpires who just want to be invisible and do a good job. And unfortunately, what Donaghy did lended credence to these guys not being worthy or not being credible. And that's a terrible thing. I also love that Sacramento Kings team that got railroaded by Donaghy. I love teams that share the ball the way they did. Probably my most favorite NBA team in the last 20 or 30 years. Great pick. I'm going to go to the sport of golf, which has always been known as a honorary, you know, play by the rules, you know, you're on your honor, call penalties on yourself. Vijay Singh got caught cheating or suspected of cheating several years ago. He's been called Cheater Singh ever since. And now we have this guy, Patrick Reed, who, man, it seems like he's got cheating scandals all over the place in college, in the pros. He just won a tournament in Mexico. So he's one of those guys. We talked about the Astros, who can handle the heat, who wants to be the villain and thrives on it. Maybe Patrick Reed does. But in a game like golf, where you're supposed to police yourself, when you can be caught red-handed on film the way they've caught Patrick Reed, I don't know that the Singh stuff will never really know the truth. But Patrick Reed, largely despised golfer. I hate to see the guy do well. He took down a really good leaderboard in Mexico, so I give him props for winning the tournament. But I'm going to root against Patrick Reed the rest of his career.
Yeah, that's a good one. It makes perfect sense. And my last one is this guy would be like right there for my least favorite professional athlete of all time. It's Ulf Samuelsson, who used to play for the Pittsburgh Penguins. Oh, so I found when we started, just as an aside, I found when I started brainstorming villains that for some reason, the nature of hockey, there are so many villains. I think it's the vigilante justice that's just especially used to be part of hockey, you know, all that vigilante justice and unwritten rules and code of conduct and when you're supposed to fight and when you're not and who you're allowed to hit and who you're not. Anyways, I found that I had so Claude Lemieux and Ken Linsman and so many guys, but Ulf Samuelsson to me takes the cake. His hockey career was just, he was a good player, but man, he would cheap shot hit with his knees like everybody in every which way. He had a visor that I swear came all the way down to his chin, so nobody could ever really get a piece of him. He's a big enough guy that he could kind of protect himself. But to me, he was just the most annoying player. And he was on those good Penguins teams, which then he won. And that made him even more annoying. So like I say, I could probably pick 10 hockey players, you know, who I could have named as the last villain. But I'm going to take Ulf Samuelsson. Nobody in hockey ever drove me nuts like he did.
I'm going to go back to the land of make-believe, Karate Kid. The Cobra guys, man, those guys sweeping the leg. Talk about sweeping the leg, right?
Yeah.
Taking somebody out cheap. I can't imagine anybody just being as sinister as those guys. Even when I rewatch that movie, I know it's going to happen. I want some vigilante justice to be thrown at the Cobra Kai. So Karate Kid, still, I think, very watchable several decades later. And the Cobra Kai's, man, let's take those guys down.
Really good one. That was on my long list too, and didn't make the cut, but that was on my list too.
Yeah, I also had Claude Lemieux on my list.
Yeah,
and I almost we talked enough about the Astros. The thing that's frustrating to me is just how tone deaf they've been. If they had just owned some of their mistakes and said, look, we screwed this up, let's make it right. I feel like that's never their approach with some of the things that they've dealt with over the last few months. So they're certainly a team I'll be rooting against this year. Well, we hope you'll be rooting for the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast in our second season again. Give us a rating and review if you can, or engage us on Twitter. We welcome your comments. How can we make this podcast better? For my excellent guest, Fred Zinke, for my killer producer, Brett Rader, I'm Scott Pianowski. Tune in next Monday. This will be our Drop Zone all season. I'll have another great guest. We'll get you ready for Yahoo Fantasy Baseball 2020. Let's have a great year. We'll talk to you soon.